and let you work on what's important every day. But of course, not all distractions are internal. Just as it's important to build up your attention muscle, it's also important to protect it from external distractions that will derail your focus and productivity. One of the things I noticed after I began to use my smartphone for just an hour a day, in addition to how much more mental clarity I began to have, was how infrequently I was interrupted. Instead of my attention being constantly hijacked, I was able to dive deeper into whatever I was working on, no matter how complicated it was, because I didn't have to constantly refocus my attention. Before the experiment, one text or interruption would instantly burst the focus bubble I was working inside of, and it took an incredible amount of time to work my way back into it. The more attention a task involved, the longer recovering from interruptions took. Unnecessary alerts may not cost you a ton of time, but they cost you a ton of attention. Every time you receive an alert for a new email, text message, Twitter mention, or Facebook notification, your attention is instantly hijacked. And this has huge productivity costs, particularly when you're working on something complex. Since transitioning from the time economy to the knowledge economy, we no longer only trade our time for a paycheck. We also trade our attention for a paycheck, including when we're not in the office. In every 9-to-5 job I've had, I was given a laptop so I could take my work home with me, and it was often expected that I would. Attention hijackers usually didn't exist after you went home from a day of working on an assembly line at a factory. When you punched out for the day, your attention was yours. Today, the opposite is the case. While it may be expected that you never disconnect, defending your attention from interruptions can produce great returns, whether you're at work or home. Chances are you're interrupted more than you realize. Interruptions blend in so seamlessly with the tapestry of our work that it's often hard to notice them at all. However, according to Rescue Time, a company that tracks exactly how people spend their time on the computer, the average knowledge worker opens his or her email program 50 times a day and uses instant messaging 77 times a day. And according to research firm BaseX, unnecessary interruptions from things like email and IM cost the U.S. economy $650 billion in lost productivity every year. It's clear that in the knowledge economy, our attention is worth quite a bit. We'll get to the massive costs of multitasking in the next chapter, which can harm your productivity even more. Also, according to BaseX, quote, interruptions and the requisite recovery time now consume 28% of a worker's day, end quote. And as Gloria Mark, an attention researcher at the University of California, discovered, quote, each employee spent only 11 minutes on any given project before being interrupted, end quote. And it took the average employee 25 minutes to return to the initial task. That's a huge price to pay to tend to pointless interruptions like emails and instant messages. After my smartphone experiment, I began doing something relatively straightforward. I shut off every single notification on my smartphone and computer. Suddenly, whenever someone texted, tweeted, or emailed me, my attention was no longer derailed from what I was working on, and I could begin to tend to the new information that came in on my own schedule and terms. Many people forget that their smartphone, computer, and other devices exist for their convenience, not the convenience of everyone who wants to interrupt them throughout the day. I don't own a watch, and so whenever I pull my smartphone out of my pocket to check the time, which happens a few times every hour, I also clear out any notifications that would have otherwise interrupted my more important work. Since my computer doesn't send me any notifications either, I clear those out at a time I pre-scheduled. The only time my work is ever interrupted is when someone comes up to me in person, when I receive a phone call, or when I receive a reminder before a meeting is about to start. To me, these interruptions are worth it, and they save me time in the long run. The reason you can't remember anything. After I disabled pretty much every notification on my devices and began to disconnect from the internet, another curious thing began to happen. I started to remember a whole lot more. The odd part about a lot of the best productivity tactics is that while they'll let you accomplish more every day, they often make you feel less productive. Tactics like stepping back from your work to plan, scheduling less time for tasks, and disconnecting from the internet all create the conditions for you to get more done. But they also make your work less stimulating, which creates the illusion that you're not accomplishing as much. Disabling distractions does the same thing. Even though pretty much every study on interruptions and multitasking shows that they hurt your productivity, your limbic system will tell you the opposite. And just like when you procrastinate, it's hard not to listen to it. But at the end of the day, all evidence points to the fact that disabling attention hijackers will let you accomplish more, not less. Especially after you account for the fact that most interruptions cost you as much as 25 minutes of productivity, you quickly realize how detrimental most of them are. But there's an equally large cost to being constantly stimulated and distracted. It affects your memory. When you repeatedly move your attentional spotlight from one thing to another, your brain gets overloaded. And when your brain is overloaded, it shifts its processing from your hippocampus, responsible for memory, to the area of your brain responsible for rote tasks, making it difficult to learn a new skill or recall what you were doing before you were interrupted. In his award-winning book, The Shallows, Nicholas Carr uses a neat analogy to describe this effect. Quote, imagine filling a bathtub with a thimble. That's the challenge involved in transferring information from working memory into long-term memory. When we read a book, the information faucet provides a steady drip, which we can control by the pace of our reading. End quote. While we read, we transfer information from our working memory to long-term memory one thimbleful at a time. The opposite happens when we use devices connected to the internet. We provide our limbic systems with a delicious stream of distractions which overloads our brain, making it difficult to transfer information from our working memory to long-term memory. From the moment we wake up to the time we go to bed, we are plugged in, connected to a steady stream of attention hijackers that derail our focus, weaken our attention muscle, and cause us to remember less. Protecting your memory is yet another reason to disable as many attention hijackers in your work as possible. I'll be honest with you. In my experience, disconnecting can be incredibly hard, especially after you grow accustomed to being steadily stimulated by distractions. As my year-long project finished up, I was still nowhere close to perfect. After disabling almost every notification after my smartphone experiment, I was still tempted to check for new messages when I didn't have a steady stream of alerts coming in. But just like starting a new workout regimen, my attention muscle was weak at first. And then it got stronger as I began to regularly defend it against attention hijackers. When you're on your deathbed, you're going to look back with satisfaction at all the cool and meaningful things you've accomplished. Not that you stayed on top of your email. Defending your attention muscle against interruptions will give you extra attention and focus to dive deeper into your work, to work more efficiently, and to become more productive. While we're on the topic of distractions, one of my favorite ways to tame the distractions around me, not interruptions or attention hijackers, but actual distractions, is by using the 20-second rule. Positive psychologists, like best-selling author Sean Acor, suggest that 20 seconds is enough temporal distance to keep distractions at bay and out of your way. And this rule can be used to your advantage. During my year of productivity, I experimented with keeping negative distractions more than 20 seconds away with a lot of success. For example, I noticed that as soon as I moved unhealthy snacks to more than 20 seconds away from where I worked, I stopped impulsively snacking almost immediately. Some more examples of the rule in action include keeping your email client buried in nested folders so it takes more than 20 seconds to access, keeping your filing cabinet right next to your desk so it takes you less than 20 seconds to file something, keeping desserts at the bottom of your freezer, keeping your phone in the other room while you work, unplugging your internet modem, and setting up a complicated 30-character password on your social media accounts. The notification challenge. Time required, 5 to 10 minutes, depending on how many devices you own. Energy and focus required, 3 out of 10, depending on how tech-savvy you are. Notification settings are usually pretty easy to find. Value, 8 out of 10. Fun, 7.2 out of 10. What you'll get out of it. You'll potentially reclaim hours of lost productivity every day because you'll no longer be interrupted by a barrage of alerts and notifications. You'll also remember quite a bit more and be able to focus more deeply on your work. When every interruption costs you about half an hour in lost productivity, it's worth taming them. If you're like me and the people I've met, you're interrupted a lot more than you realize. But thankfully, every device you own has settings to reduce and eliminate notifications. I challenge you to dive into the settings on your phone, computer, tablet, smartwatch, and every other device you own, and disable notification alerts on them all. Shut off buzzes, beeps, alert boxes, and anything else that hijacks your attention throughout the day. And be especially defensive of your attention during your biological prime time. If you like to occasionally shut your office door, but still like to remain accessible, your BPT is the best time to cordon yourself off to avoid your friends and coworkers. Any interruptions that aren't worth losing as much as 25 minutes of productivity over aren't worth keeping around. Your limbic system may feel the loss of constant stimulation a bit at first, as you adjust to not being interrupted. And you might even feel less productive because your brain isn't as stimulated. But when the day is done, you'll have a lot more attention to do meaningful and important work. Not to mention remember the cool work that you do. And as far as productivity is concerned, that's what matters. Chapter 20. The Art of Doing One Thing. Takeaway. Single tasking is one of the best ways to tame a wandering mind because it helps you build up your attention muscle and carve out more attentional space around the task you are tackling in the moment. It is also a powerful tool for improving your memory. Just as working out in the gym builds the muscles in your body, continually drawing your attention back to your chosen task has been shown to build your attention muscle. The thing about multitasking, quote, to be everywhere is to be nowhere. Seneca. To kick off this chapter, I want to give you a quick refresher on a few ideas I've mentioned already that I think are especially relevant to this chapter. One, busyness is no different from laziness when it doesn't lead you to accomplish anything. Two, productivity isn't about how busy or efficient you are. It's about how much you accomplish. And three, just because you feel productive doesn't mean you are. And the opposite is often true. I know that by now I've repeated some of these concepts enough that your eyes may be starting to glaze over, but I think each of these statements contains a kernel of truth that's so profound that they are all worth repeating again, especially as far as multitasking is concerned. Because here's the oddest thing about multitasking. Although pretty much every study has shown that it's disastrous for your productivity, we all still strive to do it. Why? Because multitasking feels amazing. The perks of being a multitasker. Many of the books I researched during my year of productivity described how terrible multitasking is in terms of productivity. And indeed, pretty much every study ever done on multitasking has shown that this is the case. But let's talk about the perks of doing more than one thing at once. In my opinion, these studies neglect to mention that multitasking feels incredible. This is where, in my opinion, a lot of productivity books miss the boat. If every decision you made was perfectly rational and your prefrontal cortex gained the upper hand over your limbic system 100% of the time, you wouldn't need this audiobook. But assuming you're a thinking, feeling, loving, breathing human being, this is what makes productivity tactics like this one hard. Work is simply more fun and stimulating when you multitask, even though when you multitask, you invariably accomplish less. After I started AYOP, at first I ignored the research on multitasking because I didn't feel like listening to it. Most days I accomplished what I intended to, and even though I wasn't focusing to the best of my ability, I was having a blast, swimming in a sea of limbic system stimulating distractions. I knew that multitasking only created the illusion of productivity, but at the same time, multitasking made my work feel way more fun and only slightly more stressful, and I felt like I was missing out on something when I tried to do just one thing at a time. Near the start of my project, I planned to experiment with single tasking, but I put off the experiment for quite a while because the idea of the experiment was so aversive to me. The busier I became, the guiltier I felt when I focused on only one thing at a time, and the more I dreaded the experiment. I was addicted to the steady stream of distractions, and multitasking had become a habit. Switching to autopilot. Habits are a powerful concept. If it weren't for them, and the fact that we perform many aspects of our life automatically without thinking, we wouldn't be able to function in the world. For example, you are now aware that your jaw has weight and requires constant effort to hold up. And if you think about it too much, you can no longer find a comfortable place in your mouth for your tongue. By the way, have you noticed how your nose is always in your peripheral vision? And that now you can't stop noticing it? And how every time you swallow, your ears click? Studies show that 40 to 45% of everything we do happens automatically. And a lot of time, that's a good thing. But some habits are counterproductive. Habits like sleeping in too late, binge-watching TV shows, smoking cigarettes, and eating too much pizza are often just as automatic, but usually counterproductive. During my Year of Productivity project, I had the chance to chat with Charles Duhigg, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Power of Habit. In his research and experimentation, he found that habits were quite simple, and that every habit was made up of three simple parts: a cue, routine, and a reward. Quote, there's the cue, which is the trigger for an automatic behavior to start, and then the routine, which is the behavior itself, and then finally, a reward, end quote. For example, when you wake up, cue, you may immediately pick up your smartphone to bounce between a bunch of different apps, routine, which lets you feel caught up and connected with the world, reward. And when you're trying to focus on an ugly task, cue, you might habitually open up your email, routine, to continue to feel productive even though you're really procrastinating, reward. The more often you do a habit, the stronger the habit becomes. On a neurological level, a habit is simply a pathway in your brain that fires in response to a cue in your environment. As Charles put it, quote, when a cue and a behavior and a reward become neurologically intertwined, what's actually happening is a neural pathway is developing that links those three things together in our head, end quote. As Donald Hebb, a Canadian psychologist widely considered to be the founder of neuropsychology, put it, quote, cells that fire together, wire together, end quote. Your smartphone and the other devices you multitask with are invisible to you because you use them habitually without much thought. And you use them in response to cues that are embedded in your environment. This concept works in positive ways too. Habits are also what let me work a new exercise and eating regimen into my life during my project, which I'll talk about in the next section. According to Duhigg, cues that trigger habits fall into one of five categories: a specific time of day, a place, a feeling, the presence of certain people, or a preceding behavior that you have ritualized. This is why creating a productive daily routine is so powerful. You do the same thing every day, and when you ensure that your routine is genuinely rewarding to you, over time, you solidify the neurological pathways in your brain until it becomes an automatic habit. The reason habits are so powerful and so difficult to break is that your brain releases dopamine, a pleasure chemical, along with the reward at the end of each neurological pathway. Over time, the more often you fire up these neurological pathways, the stronger you link the cues, routines, and rewards that make up your habits, because you reinforce the pathway that links them with that dopamine your brain loves so much. Much like repeatedly walking down a desire path, this makes your neurological pathways deeper, wider, and stronger. Multitasking is a habit because you don't do it deliberately, by choice. If you left your phone at home for a day and then walked around town without it in your pocket, chances are you would feel phantom vibrations in your leg or would automatically reach into your pocket for it even though it's not there. I tried doing this toward the start of my smartphone experiment and found I reached into my pocket without thinking about 5 times a day. Since habits are, in their most basic form, a neurological pathway embedded in your brain, they're pretty much impossible to break overnight. This goes for multitasking too. When your brain becomes accustomed to it, it's impossible to go from constantly multitasking to single tasking overnight. Multitasking is something that you have to chip away at over time. Hooked on dopamine. Studies show that your brain releases steady hits of dopamine when you work on more than one thing at once. Neurochemically speaking, your brain rewards you more when you multitask compared to when you do one thing at a time. As Daniel Levitin puts it in The Organized Mind, quote, "Multitasking creates a dopamine addiction feedback loop, effectively rewarding the brain for losing focus for constantly searching for external stimulation," end quote. But it's not just our limbic system that lusts after the sexy allure of multitasking. According to Daniel, quote, "To make matters worse, the prefrontal cortex has a novelty bias, meaning that its attention can be easily hijacked by something new, the proverbial shiny objects we use to entice infants, puppies, and kittens," end quote. No part of your brain is safe. Unless you're doing totally mindless work and have attention to spare, like on your maintenance day, your brain is simply not built to focus on more than one thing at once. In fact, your brain can't focus on two things simultaneously. Instead, it rapidly switches between them, which creates the illusion that you're doing more than one thing at a time. My favorite study on multitasking was conducted by Eyal Ophir, Clifford Nass, and Anthony Wagner at Stanford. Leading up to the study, the prevailing research had established that people couldn't simultaneously process two things at once. So the team wanted to get to the bottom of exactly what made heavy multitaskers more productive, if anything. First, they tested whether multitaskers were better at ignoring irrelevant information. They weren't. When that failed, the researchers tested whether multitaskers were better at storing and organizing information or had better memories. They weren't and didn't. Stumped, they conducted a third test to see if multitaskers were better at switching between tasks. They weren't. And to make things worse, the light multitaskers in the study were better at multitasking than the heavy multitaskers. As Eyal put it, quote, "We kept looking for what they're better at, and we didn't find it," end quote. The multitaskers perceived that they performed better because their brains were more stimulated. But in every single study, they performed worse. Multitasking makes you less productive because it makes you more prone to errors, adds stress to your work, takes longer because it costs you time and attention to switch between tasks, and even affects your memory. Much like being bombarded with interruptions and distractions, multitasking overloads your brain. This is why, when you watch a TV show or movie with your smartphone or tablet, you can't remember much of it. Multitasking even makes you more prone to experiencing boredom, anxiety, and depression. If you think back to when you accomplished the most in a single sitting, you probably weren't tending to a million things at once. Chances are, you were working with a crazy amount of focus and directing it all at just one thing. When you multitask, you only skim the surface of your work because you scatter your attention in a million different directions. This prevents you from really getting into any one thing you have to get done. It's no wonder our brains wander 47% of the time. When you do only one thing at a time, you give your work the attention it deserves. Doing just one thing. Time to check in again. How often has your mind wandered while you listened to this part of the audiobook? The more your mind has trouble focusing, the more this chapter will help you out. Of course, single tasking is easier said than done. As I found during my project, much like doing algebra or assembling IKEA furniture, single tasking is one of those ideas that works incredibly well in theory, but is insanely difficult to pull off in practice. In my experience, a big reason single tasking makes you more productive is the same reason that simplifying the tasks you take on in general makes you more productive. When you simplify the tasks, projects, and commitments you take on, you spread your time, attention, and energy across fewer things, and invest more of each into everything you do. The same is true when you do only one thing in the moment. You invest all your time, attention, and energy into just one thing, which lets you accomplish more in the same amount of time. While experimenting with single tasking during my project, I frequently fell off the wagon and went back to trying to do more than one thing at a time. The best solution I found was to start small, very small. At first, I would set a timer so I could single task for a small amount of time, like 20 minutes, which I gradually increased as I began to build up my attention muscle. By the end of my project, I focused on only one thing at a time, all day. Like most other tactics I discuss in this book, I'd be lying if I said I was perfect at it, but I did improve each week. Something incredible happens when, over time, you push back against your wandering mind and continually bring your attention back to your most important work. You strengthen your ability to focus your attention on a task. Research shows that when you repeatedly make a conscious effort to refocus on your work after your mind wanders, over time, you heighten your executive control, harnessing the power your prefrontal cortex has over your limbic system, and ultimately, the control your brain has over itself. Every time you bring your attention back to a single task, you reinforce that habit, which gradually becomes stronger over time, particularly when you consciously fend off distractions and interruptions in the first place. Going from dedicating 53% of your attention to your work to 80 or 90% isn't a process that happens overnight, but it's well worth the effort, and it can produce incredible results, especially when you single task on your most important tasks. Here are a few of my favorite ways to practice single tasking and build up my attention muscle. Work on Pomodoro time. The Pomodoro technique, developed by Francesco Cirillo in the 1980s, is a simple time management technique that's also very powerful. With the technique, you work on only one task for 25 minutes and then take a 5-minute break. After four periods of working for 25 minutes, you take a longer break of 15 minutes or more. I think this is one of the very best ways to try single tasking on for size. After a few Pomodori, I think you'll be sold. I don't find this technique to be effective all the time, but it's a great hack for dedicating a lot of energy and attention to high return tasks. Conference calls. When on a conference call, try not to check for email or messages and simply focus on bringing as much attention and value to the call as possible. Every time you're tempted to focus on something else, bring your attention back to the call to perform one repetition of exercising your attention muscle. If you can't stop thinking of other things, question why you agreed to the call in the first place. Listening. When you actively listen to someone, you bring all your attention and focus to the conversation you're having without trying to think of what to say next, or thinking about or doing other things. Every time you bring your attention back to the conversation in front of you, you perform one repetition of exercising your attention muscle. This tactic takes practice, but over time, it helps you better manage your attention, develop deeper and more meaningful relationships, and leads to fewer misunderstandings. While experimenting with active listening during my project, I found that almost everyone appreciated when I was able to bring my complete attention to the conversation. One of the first things I do when I meet up with someone is to shut my phone completely off so I can create the conditions to focus just on the conversation in front of me. Productivity aside, this will also work wonders for your relationships. Reading. Like the challenge at the beginning of this section of the audiobook, when you read, try to devote as much attention to what you're reading as you can. Notice when your mind begins to wander, and then rein it back in to perform another repetition of your attention muscle. Also notice when your mind gets anxious and ahead of itself, like when it starts to turn the page before you're finished reading the current one. Eating. This is a fun one to try. It's a little hard to do when you're in the office, but it's a great way to work out your attention muscle at home. When was the last time you sat down to eat without doing anything else at the same time? When you slow down while eating or drinking something, you create attentional space around the flavors and textures of what you're eating so you can enjoy it that much more. This is a fun test to observe how often your brain naturally wanders. Simply set a timer for a few minutes, sit down somewhere quiet with a drink or food of your choice. This is especially fun when you pick something tasty, and focus on the flavors and textures of what you're eating. As with reading, be mindful that your mind doesn't get ahead of itself, that it doesn't think about or start to get to the next bite before you're done with the present one. My bet is you'll be surprised by two things: how frequently your mind wanders, and how delicious food can be when you slow down enough to taste it. If you want to have even more fun with this one, try eating your food twice as slow. You'll get to enjoy it for twice as long. The key to all these tactics is to constantly bring your attention back to the task at hand when it wanders off. Every time you re-engage your wandering mind with the task at hand, your attention muscle becomes that much stronger, and you'll heighten the amount of control you have over your mind so you can prevent it from wandering off in the future. This isn't easy, which is why I recommend starting out small, but it's well worth the effort. I found single tasking has a bunch of other benefits too. After I began to single task and work at a slower, more deliberate pace, I began to become much more aware of what I was working on, what habits I was doing automatically, the value of what I was working on, and even when I was procrastinating. Instead of my mind bouncing between the devices and apps I was using, I had the chance to reflect on the value of the work I was doing, which let me step back from my work in the moment to reflect on how to work smarter and even more creatively. Research shows that it's easier to think creatively when you're calm and unhurried. Single tasking also gave me the attentional space to become more compassionate, considerate, and happy. I'm a huge believer in being compassionate as you invest in your productivity, both to other people and to yourself. For example, compassion helps you behave less like a robot when you fend off low-impact tasks and projects. Doing just one thing at a time takes some adjustment, but in addition to helping you get more done, I think doing so will help you become a better human being too. I think this is the reason a lot of people want to become more productive in the first place. As Matthew Killingsworth and Daniel Gilbert, the two psychologists who conducted the 47% study, put it, quote, "A human mind is a wandering mind," end quote. And research shows that, quote, "A wandering mind is an unhappy mind," end quote. From an evolutionary standpoint, quote, "The ability to think about what is not happening is a cognitive achievement that comes at an emotional cost, end quote. You have a very limited amount of time. This is what makes productivity so important, but it's also why you should slow down and actually enjoy yourself as you invest in your productivity. Single tasking is one of the best ways to tame a wandering mind and carve out more attentional space around your tasks in the moment. The final step to working deliberately and with intention. The single tasking challenge. Time required, 15 to 30 minutes. Energy and focus required, 9 out of 10. Value, 10 out of 10. Fun, 8 out of 10. What you'll get out of it. You'll build up your attention muscle, so you can become able to devote more of yourself to the task at hand, which will let you get more done in the same amount of time. My challenge for you this chapter is to spend between 15 and 30 minutes tomorrow focusing on just one thing. If the thought of this experiment puts you off, just shrink how long you'll single task for until you feel less resistance to it. Whether you decide to dedicate all your attention to your work, a phone call, conversation, book, or piece of food you're eating, for 15 to 30 minutes, focus on just one thing. Naturally, the more important the task is, the more you'll get out of this challenge. Whenever your mind wanders, and it will, especially at first, gently bring it back. Don't be too hard on yourself. Simply redirect your focus when you notice your mind thinking about something other than the task at hand. This is a simple challenge, but deceivingly so. Over time, the benefits of doing this will compound and blow you away. Chapter 21, the meditation chapter. Takeaway. Practicing mindfulness and meditation makes you more productive because it makes your mind calmer, happier, and more focused. Meditation is also far less intimidating than you imagine. A confession. I have a confession to make to you. That last chapter was a total sham. It wasn't about single tasking at all. It was about mindfulness. Before you put this audiobook down in disgust and write me off forever, please give me a chance to explain. Mindfulness has a massive PR problem. It's hard to overstate this point. When a lot of people hear the word mindfulness, or even worse, meditation, their mind flashes to images of a skinny yogi sitting on a meditation cushion for hours on end in the middle of the sweltering heat in India. Or to a Buddhist monk who lives in a cave, eats beans and rice all day long, and lives in total silence. Like hearing about mission statements, I think a lot of people immediately tune out when they hear the words. At least I sure did at first. But the thing is, this isn't accurate. Mindfulness is simply the art of deliberately doing one thing at a time. And meditation is much the same, only instead of doing it alongside other tasks, you practice it by itself. I'll get to how to meditate, which is amazingly simple, in a bit. If you wanted to, you could go through that last chapter, swap out every single mention of single tasking for mindfulness, and it would still make sense. This is what that hippie mindfulness thing is all about, creating more attentional space around the present moment so you can focus completely on what you're doing. That's pretty much it. It also means reflecting on how you're feeling about what you're doing and what you think about what you're working on, which is important for a ton of productivity tactics like the ones that help you beat procrastination. When your attention is scattered all around you, like when you're multitasking, you simply aren't dedicating as much of yourself to the task at hand as you could be, which makes you less productive. Mindfulness and meditation are about building up how much control you have over your attention, so you can direct more of it toward the task at hand. On the surface, mindfulness and meditation seem like the antithesis of productivity. But in a world where productivity is about working smarter and more deliberately instead of doing more faster, they have never been more relevant or more important. On the assembly line, 53% of your attention was enough to do a great job. Today, your work benefits from all the attention you can dedicate to it. The hard part about productivity. Just like a lot of people love the idea of waking up at 5:30 or running a marathon in theory, pretty much everyone loves the idea of getting more done. But when it comes to working on the most productive things in the moment, the reality is that we usually have to make a lot of short-term sacrifices to accomplish more. In the long term, our planning, logical, prefrontal cortex wants to have 10% body fat and become VP. But in the moment, we'd rather be playing hooky and grabbing a cheeseburger. To get a sexy six-pack, you can't just decide to eat better. Every day, you have to make a dozen small sacrifices to chip away at the body fat you have, which is infinitely more difficult than forming that original resolution to lose weight. The same holds true for when you try to single task, work harder, or beat procrastination. It feels great to make resolutions, but making a million small sacrifices to actually achieve them is usually a lot less fun. This is the hard part about productivity. While almost every single person on the planet wants to accomplish more, and usually knows at least one change they can make to take a step in the right direction, in the moment, it's difficult to do what it takes to get there. This is in part why I spent the entire first chapter talking about values. If you don't value the changes you're trying to make or have a deep reason for why you want to accomplish more, you won't have the motivation in the moment to make short-term sacrifices to reach your long-term goals. This is where mindfulness comes in. Mindfulness is important because we value things differently in the moment than we do in the long term. And mindfulness gives us the attentional space we need to switch off autopilot and make more productive decisions in the moment. When we work automatically and lean too much on our habits, we have less attentional space for our prefrontal cortex to intervene to make the most productive decision. Mindfulness lets us carve out more attentional space in the moment to work smarter and more deliberately. You'll still have to make the sacrifices. But mindfulness and meditation let you lay more productivity groundwork and create space around your tasks to make the best possible decisions in the moment. Bit flipping. When my meditation practice slipped towards the beginning of my project and I picked it back up again, I quickly began to notice the profound benefits meditation had on my productivity. And every single one of those benefits orbited around having a stronger attention muscle. Interestingly enough, some of the strongest advocates for meditation that I have met, aside from meditators themselves, were procrastination researchers. And this makes sense. The single best way to work out your attention muscle, the amount of control your prefrontal cortex has over your limbic system, is to meditate. In fact, when I interviewed Tim Pitchell, he was effusive in his praise for mindfulness and meditation and saw it as a powerful way to, quote, direct our attention to where it would be most useful to us, end quote. Mindfulness and meditation have also both been shown to help with impulsiveness, the character trait that contributes the most to procrastination. After I resumed my meditation practice, I was immediately able to see the difference meditation made on my productivity. For one, I procrastinated less. Since meditation and mindfulness both build your attention muscle, I was able to focus on how I was feeling and what I was thinking about so I could step back and face my procrastination head on. I also began to have much more impulse control, which helped me solidify my ritual of waking up at 5:30 every morning and then reflect on how much I hated it. It gave me more attentional space in a moment-by-moment basis to step back, work deliberately, and see my work and life from 10,000 feet. It also made it easier to manage my energy throughout the day. Meditation and mindfulness gave me the awareness I needed to step back from my work to become more productive. Five myths about meditation and productivity. Before jumping into how to meditate, which is way easier and far less mysterious than you think, I want to get a few quick meditation myths out of the way. I've had the chance to speak with a lot of people, especially business people, about why they're resistant to the practice. Here are five of the most common meditation myths I've encountered, particularly as far as productivity is concerned. 1. Meditation makes you more passive. Don't worry. Meditation won't turn you into a wimp. If anything, it'll help you become more resilient to the challenges you face. And at the same time, meditation changes how you relate to your experiences. Two people can experience the exact same thing and think about it completely differently. Meditation helps you see things more positively, but it also helps you become more resilient. 2. Meditation makes you less motivated. Au contraire, my friend. Meditation helps you focus more on your goals and on why you're doing them. You'll be more motivated to become more productive, if anything, because you'll have the clarity to see why you're doing what you're doing. 3. Meditation will make you care less about your work. Just as meditation won't make you more passive, it also won't make you care less about your work. If anything, it'll help you see the deeper meaning behind what you do, which will make you care more about what's on your plate, assuming what you're working on is aligned to what you value. Meditation won't make you care less about your accomplishments. It'll help you focus on them more. 4. Meditation takes too much time. I meditate for 30 minutes a day, but even 1 minute a day can make a profound difference. You can do pretty much anything for a minute. 5. It's too hard to get started. It's actually pretty easy. Here's how. Meditation is actually insanely simple. Meditation is simple, almost stupidly so. The practice is like single tasking, only taken up a notch or two. While single tasking and mindfulness are things you practice as you do something else, meditation is something you do by itself. They have the same benefits, though the benefits of meditation are more concentrated, with the main difference being when and where you practice them. Meditation and mindfulness are two sides of the same coin. Here's how to meditate. Find somewhere quiet where you won't be distracted or interrupted. Sit upright. You don't have to buy a meditation mat or anything. A chair works fine for pretty much everyone. Sit upright so that the vertebrae in your back are stacked one on top of another. You shouldn't feel stiff. You should feel relaxed, but alert. You can close your eyes or not. Up to you. Whatever helps you feel more alert is what you should do. I find if I meditate closer to bedtime, I need to keep my eyes open a bit so I can focus better. Set a timer for however long you want to meditate. I use my phone's clock app. I like to have my timer count upwards in case I want to go for longer, but most people I know have their meditation timer count downward. Choose an amount of time you don't feel a ton of mental resistance to, however short that may be. After you set your timer for however long feels comfortable, I recommend starting with 5 minutes. Focus on your breath. Observe all the sensations you feel as your breath flows in and out of your body, into your nose, down your esophagus, into your lungs, and then out again. Don't try to control your breath. Simply observe it. Don't try to analyze it or anything. Just notice its natural rhythms. And finally, here's the part that works out your attention muscle. When your attention wanders to focus on something else, and you notice that it has wandered, which can sometimes take a minute or two, bring your attention back to concentrate on your breath. You'll have to do this repeatedly while you meditate. This is normal, and this is what heightens your executive functioning. When thoughts or feelings come up, don't judge them. Just notice them, as if they're cars on a highway, and you're on an overpass overlooking them. And remember, when your mind wanders, and it will, that this is what your mind was programmed to do. When you approach meditation with a genuine curiosity of where your mind will wander off to, you'll get that much more out of it. I sometimes like to laugh when my mind wanders, which must look pretty weird to anyone watching. This is all meditation is. And mindfulness? Mindfulness is simply single tasking, so you can carve out space around tasks, which lets you become aware of what you're feeling and what you're thinking about. Meditation is mindfulness from concentrate. To me, it seems almost comical that these practices are so simple and yet have so many benefits, but they do. Over the last several decades, a wealth of neurological research has shown just how beneficial the practices are. I think the most powerful finding, at least as far as productivity is concerned, is how the practice heightens your executive control and works out your attention muscle. Sarah Lazar, a neuroscientist at Harvard Medical School, has studied this effect firsthand, and she found that long-term meditators have lower brain activity in their posterior cingulate cortex, PCC, the part of the brain responsible for mind wandering. According to Lazar, quote, better control over the PCC can help you catch your mind in the act of wandering and nudge it gently back on task, end quote. Meditation helps you regain control over your attention and by extension, your brain, and prevent it from wandering when you don't want it to. Both meditation and mindfulness are worth it for this reason alone. But you also experience a bunch of secondary benefits that make the practices doubly worthwhile. There aren't enough pages in this book to lay out all the benefits of meditation. It reduces your cortisol levels, calms you down, increases blood flow to your brain, makes your brain age more slowly, and increases the amount of gray matter in your brain, the stuff responsible for muscle control, seeing, hearing, memory, emotions, and speech. Meditation has even been shown to boost your test scores. And if you have a team, the more mindful you are, the higher the performance of your team. All these effects, every one backed up by scores of neuroscientific research, will help you boost your productivity. In meditation, you'll observe firsthand your limbic system putting up a fight against your prefrontal cortex. It will tell you you're bored, frustrated, guilty, worried, restless, and you might even give into it once or twice when you first start meditating. Chances are, it will also wander to something in your future, to a cringe-worthy memory that happened in your past, and then to a crazy fantasy with Mila Kunis or Brad Pitt. This is just the brain operating at its regular pace, and every time you bring it back, you'll have performed one rep of your attention muscle. Just like when you battle procrastination, this will light your brain on fire. If you're anything like the version of me that was put off by the idea of meditation before trying it out in my very first yoga class, my guess is that right now, your limbic system is resisting the idea of meditation, maybe quite a bit. But here's the thing. This is exactly what makes meditation worthwhile. In my opinion, for every minute you meditate, you gain back 10 minutes of productivity. Meditation helps you focus better, waste less time, work more intentionally, and also makes it easier to identify high return tasks and, over time, resist your brain's limbic system. Focus and awareness are two of the largest parts of your attention muscle, and there is no better way to work them out than to single task and meditate. Micro-intentions. If you asked me to name a city that isn't mindful or deliberate, I would almost immediately say New York. At least in my experience, New York is the least calm, patient, and mindful city I've been in. But that hasn't stopped Sharon Salzberg from making the city her home. Sharon is an incredible woman. After a turbulent childhood, she lived with five different families by the age of 16. Sharon became enamored with Buddhism while learning about it in an Asian philosophy course in college. That motivated her to travel to India to delve into the practice. Today, many years later, she is widely credited with bringing Buddhism and meditation to the West in the 1970s, after she returned from India and then founded the Insight Meditation Society with Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield. Sharon is also the author of a number of best-selling books, including Real Happiness at Work, where she talks about how to bring mindfulness to work without compromising your performance or productivity. To interview Sharon, I flew to New York City and met her at her apartment A 5-minute walk from Union Square, one of the last places on Earth you'd expect to find a meditation teacher. But once you meet her, the whole thing starts to make a lot more sense. Sharon speaks like a regular New Yorker, though you get the feeling that she has all the time in the world for you. And despite living a calm and mindful life, she blends in well with the fabric of the city. She walks a little more mindfully than most, but aside from that, she blended in perfectly. You wouldn't be able to pick her out of a crowd as a meditation teacher. Despite her history with meditation and Buddhism, Sharon doesn't have any illusions about how difficult it is to live mindfully in this day and age. She doesn't think meditation has to be tied to a particular belief system or that you have to be, quote, in a pretzel-like pose in order to do it, end quote. She also doesn't have any unrealistic ideas about how much time we have for the practice. In our chat, she referenced research that 5 or 10 minutes a day is enough to rewire your brain and completely change the way you see your work and your life. Sharon takes a practical approach to meditation and considers it a way of living more deliberately, getting in touch with yourself, and living a happier life. Not a path to ditching all your possessions to live in a monastery trying to achieve enlightenment. Perhaps the most interesting nugget she mentioned during our chat, though, is the idea of integrating mindfulness into your day, which lets you carve out even more attentional space around your work and even set tiny intentions for what you want to accomplish. When contemplating how she could help people practice mindfulness every day, much like Charles Duhigg, she discovered that we already have a lot of cues embedded in our work environment. Different events that occur regularly that can serve as triggers for us to practice mindfulness, where we can take a few seconds to step back, observe our breath, and how we're feeling, and calm down throughout the day. This can be as simple as letting a phone ring until the third ring instead of the first, so we can take a few seconds to slow down and be with ourselves. Or waiting a few seconds before hitting send on an email, and instead taking a breath or two and reading over the email again. Or using the time it takes to walk from one room to another to simply walk and be present. Mindfulness lets you work more deliberately in the moment because it lets you actually take a step back to think about what you want to accomplish, how you're feeling, and what you're thinking about. According to Sharon, the opportunities to do this throughout the day are endless. Quote, before a conversation, before a meeting, before an encounter of any kind, step back and see if you can check in with yourself to see what your intention is. What do you most want to see come out of a conversation? Then work toward that instead of getting caught up in what you're feeling, end quote. Mindfulness lets you set micro-intentions throughout the day, which accumulate by the end of the day to make you a lot more productive. It's in this moment-to-moment deliberateness, where we step back from our work, not just in general, but in the moment, that the heart of productivity lies. When you work on autopilot, it's hard to be deliberate and take control of your productivity. Habits no doubt have their place, and I'll talk about them in the very next section, but it's impossible to work deliberately without a solid amount of attentional space or a strong attention muscle. Mindfulness lets you step back and create space around your tasks in the moment so you can work more intentionally. Partway through our chat, I noticed that on the desk behind Sharon was an iMac, iPad, and iPhone, and that as we spoke, she had a very steady stream of notifications flying in from every direction. While she could probably stand to shut a few of those off, I also couldn't help but notice that she wasn't fazed by a single one of them, and that she wasn't tempted to check up on what was coming in while we were chatting. Even though she received a new email every minute or two, her focus wasn't swept up by the steady stream of limbic jacking interruptions. And in the cab ride, on the way to her event, not once did she pull her iPhone out of her pocket, no matter how often her phone cried out for her attention. In my eyes, Sharon is Exhibit A of the power of mindfulness and meditation. It's not easy to train your brain to become strong enough to overpower your limbic system at every turn, but she has done it. It's also, of course, not easy to go from traversing a tough childhood to writing 9 best-selling books, but she's done that, too. And in New York, there aren't many people as compassionate or productive as her. The idea that mindfulness and meditation are concepts that need to remain within the confines of yoga studios and Lululemon stores is over. And that moment was over the moment we moved from working in the time economy to working in the knowledge economy. The most productive people are the ones who work deliberately. And there is no better way to work deliberately than developing and defending a strong attention muscle. The meditation challenge. Time required, 5 minutes a day for a week. Energy and focus required, 9 out of 10. Value, 9 out of 10. Fun, 7 out of 10. What you'll get out of it? You'll build up your attention muscle even more than with single tasking, which will let you keep your long-term goals in mind in the moment and act much more deliberately. My challenge for you is to work out your attention muscle for 5 minutes every day for the next 7 days, either by meditating or integrating mindfulness into your day. If your brain is resisting this challenge more than the others in the book, that's normal, since meditation and mindfulness are ways of training your mind to overpower your brain's instinctual limbic system. Your limbic system is going to put up a fight when you first sit down to meditate. But every time you bring your wandering mind back to focus on your breath, your attention muscle will become stronger, and you will be able to work more deliberately. It's normal for your brain to resist a challenge like this one, so let's make it a bit more fun. I challenge you to give this experiment a shot for just a few days, and simply observe what happens, especially how different you think and feel afterwards.